Afternoon. Lovely to be with you all again and hearing the Word of God together. This week particularly, as we look at today's topic of God and sex. God and sex, which is, it can make us a bit hot and clammy on a lovely spring afternoon. Think about God and sex and relationships. Sex and relationships are a wonderful gift from God. God-given, full of joy. And a bit like things that are wonderful and full of joy and fun, there can also be a shadow side. So wonderful is the gift that if used wrongly, it can cause great despair and destruction. 2 weeks ago, down at Robertson Primary, where our kids are at school, there was the Sunday afternoon fete, big shebang. There was teacup rides and Ferris wheel rides, and then there's that spinny one where 20 kids get on it and it just starts spinning like crazy. And then it starts that sort of rotation thing. It goes on an angle of like 70 degrees. And of our three girls, two of them had spent their $25 on getting the armband, which gives you unlimited rides all day. The other one, Amy, had wanted to try and spend a bit of money on the goodies, the food and other sorts of things. So she didn't go that. On the car ride home, Amy, what rides did you go on? You know, she was more buying the food. Oh, just two of them. Emma, oh, I went on this one six times, this spinny one. Emma's nine. Heidi, she's looking a bit tired in the back seat. What'd you do, Heidi? Oh, 13 times. we didn't have seen her afternoon. She was just perpetually in motion. such fun, though, for a little seven-year-old to be perpetually in motion doing this spinny thing. But such disaster if that thing falls apart. 40 little kids, all 7 years old, that would be a mangle of steel and mush and death all over the place. If such a fun thing can also have a shadow side of potential disaster if wrongly used, if things aren't used in the way that they're intended. Today's topic, God and sex, it comes with a great big fat warning as well as we approach this topic today. It's there in our passage in the second reading, verse 5 and 6 are the great big warning for us as we approach this wonderful gift of sex and sexuality. For you may be sure of this, that anyone who is sexually immoral or impure, or who is covetous, that is an idolater, has no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ or God. Let no one deceive you with empty words. For because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Isn't that a warning from God? Clear letters, top of the page, entry sign to sex and sexuality and relationships. You walk in the door, here's the warning sign. Let's hear it again. It's so stark and important. For you may be sure of this, that everyone who is sexually immoral or impure, or who is covetous, that is an idolater, has no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ or God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, but because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience. And so this warning itself is a wonderful gift from God for us as we approach this subject of such joy. If you've used God's gift of sex and relationships in the wrong way, you'll face the judgment of God. A 5-minute fling, a one night dalliance, it's not worth it. It's not worth it because the judgment of God is coming for such things. As we approach this topic and the next few weeks, we're getting very practical in the Christian life. How ought we live? We approached this 2 weeks ago as we started into the practicalities, and the first Christian ethic to think about is the fact that we actually belong to a body. I'm not my own. I belong to you, and you belong to me, and together we are a body who belongs to Jesus Christ. And our first plank to put down as we think about how to live is to be aware of the fact that we belong to a body, and the body comes first. We're here for the growth of the body, not for my personal gain. And as we approach these topics, and this one as well, we've got to remember the gospel as we come to this, because it's such an area of destruction and despair. And we need to make sure we approach this one particularly, knowing that there is forgiveness of sins. Knowing that there is forgiveness of sins. For this topic and the ones that come each week, I'm going to do a little short reminder of the gospel. because this is how Paul structures his letter to the Ephesians. He said, three chapters, here's the gospel, your sins are forgiven. Nothing has been, Jesus died. And now chapters 4 to 6. With that in mind, now go and live this way, worthy of this calling you've received. The danger is, as we step into these later chapters, we can forget the fact that once and for all Jesus died and was secure. The danger is, as we approach these chapters, we can forget that, and what we end up doing is saying, oh, I better live sexually pure so that I can get into God's good books in heaven. That's not the case. He's died for you, Jesus did. You're in. You can approach God. But given that you're in, let's live morally pure lives. So my example for today is darkness and light. Darkness and light are two pictures that are used at the bottom of this passage. Light of salvation. Come in, guys. Grab a seat. We got the Gospel Students Bible Talk now. Yeah, come on, grab up to Jeff and Mark at the back. Yeah. The world is divided into two categories. There is the light of salvation, and there is the realm of darkness and judgment. Light and salvation and darkness and judgment. We used to live below the line. Where did you used to live? You used to live below the line. We need to grasp this reality. How is it that we move above the line to live in light in the salvation of God? Well, if you look at the first few verses from today, verse 17 and 18 say, now I say and testify in the Lord, you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. They're darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance in them due to the hardness of their heart. Look at the situation of the Gentiles. Their thinking was mush. Their brains didn't even think about the reality that there's another world realm up here that they could participate in. They were ignorant and darkened. They lived in the dark and were happy in the dark. Not only were their minds mush, also, it's due to the ignorance, due to the hardness of their heart. Notice end of verse 18. Their hearts also had no desire to be above the line. This is where we were apart from Christ. Our brains didn't even think about it. Our hearts didn't even want to get there. And on top of that, our actions, our hands say, yeah, however you think of actions, we're just unable to get there. He's not giving the finger to anyone, if that's what that looks like. to the light of salvation he did. Let's start again. Here we are. Thumbs up. Yeah, I'm happy on below the line. This is the situation that we were in. How would we get above the line? How would we enter the light of salvation rather than living in the dark and facing the judgment of God? Well, it's because, and we need to remember this, it wasn't because anything that you did or desired or thought. You were not good enough. Your intentions deep down inside you, brothers and sisters, they were shot. It's not that God looks really, really, really deep inside you. He found something desiring him beneath and therefore you're above the... No, that's not the case. Your heart was also undesiring of God. Your mind didn't think about it. What went on was Jesus turned up. Jesus did have the heart and the actions and the mind to live in the light. He came, the pure one, and stood with us, next to us, joined with us, and he died our judgment upon the cross. It is his sharing our world and dying for us that means that we now freely have just been transferred above the line to walk in the light. We need to remember this as we approach this topic today, because it's not going to be you living a more sexually pure life that's somehow going to sort of scratch you above the line into God's good books. That's not how it works. You are transferred here freely already because Jesus Christ died. Now, why this is so important is that last week we had a wonderful week. I had Zombie Week. There was us and a few more here. There was 20-odd at Wednesday's session last week. We had about 40, 50 people come last week to hear the gospel. Two people said they want to consider giving their lives to Christ. We need to pray that that will be the case and I'll be established in the faith. Last week we gave three talks on campus, Zombie Week, about resurrection from the dead. Do not think that your friends on this campus are objective thinkers. Do not be deceived that your friends here are objective, rationally minded people. If a rationally thinking person got wind last week that us, reasonable people, were giving a talk about the fact that you might be able to live again forever and ever, you would think that hundreds of people were being here last week. Wouldn't that be the case? If our friends are there were rationally minded, that there was some possibility that these people who seem normal and reasonable were actually speaking about the reality of living again forever, we would have had thousands here last week. But the fact that we didn't have thousands here last week is evidence again that your friends are not rationally minded, objective, clear thinking people. It is just not the case. Their minds are mush. Their brains are addled. They're futile in their thinking. It's there again in verses 18 and also 19. 18, they're darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that's in them due to the hardness of their heart. They become callous and have given themselves up to sensuality, to greed, to practice every kind of impurity. This is what our friends on campus are like. And the fact they didn't want to come and hear resurrection from the dead from reasonably minded people last week is testimony again to that fact. Now, on Monday, at the Macrobat campus, so I was chatting to one student there, short conversation, it ended by him saying that he doesn't like the idea of putting faith in a man. He prefers to put faith in a force that runs the world. I don't like putting faith in a man. I prefer the idea of putting trust in a force that runs the world. Which is stupid thinking, futile thinking, as if you can decide reality by what you like. As if I prefer this way of the reality being construed, so because I prefer the idea of putting a trust in a force rather than faith in a man, therefore I'm going to put trust in a force and deny the reality, the possibility of there could actually be a man who rose from the dead. It's a bit like you've been granted by mum because you're home late for yet another night, and you're a bit upset at mum because you can't go out for the next week after 9 o'clock at night, and so you no longer like mum. Not liking mum anymore, she just disappears because you just don't like her anymore. This is the sort of logic that your friends on campus have in their head. I just don't like the idea of Jesus, therefore I'm not going to investigate the reality. Now, of course, if you pulled apart a university student's brain and had a look at the mush that's sitting there, what you'd see is that further down beneath, the real puppet master pulling the strings of that brain is the heart beneath. It's the heart beneath. It's there in verse, end of verse 18. because of the ignorance that is in them, their brains don't work due to the hardness of their heart. It's because they're hard, their hearts are hard, that their brain doesn't work. We are not just fighting against people who aren't thinking well. What we are contending against is unwilling hearts. It's not your fault that all of your friends that you asked didn't come last week. It's not my fault that the people I spoke to didn't come last week. Their brains are mush and their hearts don't desire to know Jesus Christ. Our battle is against unwilling hearts. Our world is quite open about its stupid thinking. You hear it all the time when someone has got a major life choice in front of them. This degree is difficult. I want to do this other degree instead. I'm coming to the end, but I'm not in it anymore. I just don't want to do it. The advice comes back, as long as it makes you happy. What is that advice doing? It's saying to you, if your heart isn't in it, just go and do something else. You do what you like. If you don't like it, don't do it anymore. If you're in a relationship that's not going well, marriage is going tough, should some of you get married down the track, the world's advice to you, our world's stupid thinking, is, oh, it's a bit hard, I just don't like her anymore, the world will say, well, get out, because it's not making you happy. Our world is ruled by the puppet master of the desires of the heart. It is not ruled by rational thinking. And so Jesus is the heretic of our world. Jesus is the apostate one in our world, because he'll say to you, no, stick at it. Persevere in the pain, because it's not your heart that rules, it's doing the right and godly thing is the thing to stick at. Jesus is the apostate one in this world, because the world doesn't like the truth of sticking to righteousness. It wants to just do what it wants to do all of the time. So, for this week, God and sexuality, what we're battling against is our world's evil hearts and also our old hearts that keep hanging around. As we think about God and sex, it's our desires and our heart within which ends up ruling our mind and ruling our actions. My encouragement for you today is to guard your heart. Guard what you desire. Because if you desire something, your mind will justify it and you'll just go and do it. An excellent book for today's passage and topic on God and sexuality is this one by Michael Hill. It's called The How and Why of Love, which is an unfortunate title because it sounds like a sex manual, but it's not. It's a book about ethics. How do we do ethics? How do we do love in this world? The gold is in the middle of the book where Michael Hill asks the question, what's the fundamental unit of our social relationships? What's the fundamental unit of society in which we live? On the one extreme, is it the individual? Or is it the other extent, and the extreme, is it the collective whole of which we belong? At the one extreme, the individual, we could call it individualism or methodological individualism. This is where, say, Bill has certain wants or desires, and so because Bill has those wants and desires, they need to be protected. Bill should get to do what he wants to do. At the other extreme, selfish Bill anger is about to say, at the other extreme, it's not that Bill particularly matters. We all dissolve your individuality. We don't care about what you want anymore. We're concerned for the whole of the group. What's good for us all as a group is more important than what's good for Bill. How do we think about this further? Consider you've got a car in front of you. You pull it apart as much as you can. I'm not a car guy, but I assume you can pull it all apart. You stick it in a box. We need to ask the question, do you still have a car in the box? Is that all the pieces are there that make up a car, but do you say there's still a car there or not? On the one hand, the answer is yes, because all the bits are there. But another angle, well, probably not, because you can't turn the thing on and drive anywhere. What this shows is that, yes, we care for Bill, and Tim's got desires, and so does Ryan, but there is something more than just the individuals in the room. But at the other end of the extreme, we don't go quite the collectivistness completely, because this is what, say, Lenin and Stalin did in the 1920s and 1930s. Because the state as a whole was more important than the individuals, gave them permission to just exterminate millions. The individual does not matter, so we can just get rid of them. Now, of those two extremes, the air that we breathe is more the individualist end. As Westerners, we are the individualist thinking people. The idea that for Stalin to exterminate someone because he doesn't like that person, the state's more important, we jump up and down, no, that one person actually really matters. So we don't go to that end, but we exist very much at the other end in the individual world. Now let me give you an example. So if you think about university, what's your goal for the end of your degree? How do you want to progress? How do you want life to be different by the time you get to the end from the beginning? You're at the start, you've grown up a bit, bigger head, you're at the end. What's different about you as you go from a first year to graduation. How does this change? Any thoughts? How's life different at the end?
Does anything change?
Well, hopefully something changes.
We know more and can do more.
Okay, cool. So, it's a group of graduation we're after, yes. So, you're hoping to start with a small brain, and you'd like to finish university with a big brain. This is your goal for university. Your brain has grown larger through your years of studiousness here on campus. You want to be able to do more. Exactly. You started with a little high school certificate. You want to be able to have a degree at least by the end, maybe two, more than just a diploma. You want a full degree here so you can go and do more in the world. Other desires? You might start with $200 in the bank because that's all that your savings gave you when you're in high school and pocket money from mum. You want to finish uni with a few grand in the bank. You want to have a nice big back pocket of money as you finish university. This is how we think about how we progress in life. Bigger brains, bigger back pocket, bigger degree, more power. Notice the fundamental reality of what's going on here. It is about you as an individual. No one else is in the picture. This is our individual Westernism that is so ingrained in who we are. We're not the collectivist people, we are the individuals. So all I think about at university is the place where I can come and I can get a degree. Or where I come and I can get a learn more stuff for my sake in years to come. There's no need to apologise for this. This is something that you've inherited from mum and dad, from those in society, your brothers and sisters. We do it in the church. We are just individualistic thinking people. Michael Hill's book, I recommend it to you. Michael Hill searches through the scriptures and shows us that there's another way. It's not that they're individuals. It's not that they're the collectivist whole. There is another way. And the third, more biblical way, is that we are people who are in relationship with other people. This is the biblical paradigm. This is the paradigm in which God has really made the world. It's not just about me, and it's not a lot of people that we just lose a sense of connectiveness, it's just some big lump. The reality in which we live, that God has made us, is that we are individuals in relationship with other people. The thing to grow and progress in is that our relationships are a thing. Relationships here are a thing. And this is the core part of reality that we are to preserve and to grow in. Now let me give you an example. Look at the self-centered Gentile here in verse 19. They have become callous and have given themselves up to sensuality. That picture there, they become callous. Where do you see the callousness in this picture here? Where do you see the callousness? This one here.
You don't care if anyone else graduates.
Yeah, that's right. It's just about you graduating. You're not concerned at all for anything else going on outside this circle. Exactly. You don't care about the other person. You become calloused, hardened to those around you. The next little bit. Greedy to practice every kind of impurity. Where do you see that in this picture here?
Bigger pocket.
It's just you want stuff flooding into your circle. In the calloustness, if reality, which it is this way, you're conscious here that you're in relation to someone else, so you're sensitive to them the whole time, you're not calloused to them. And also, you're not greedy, because if you know that if stuff's flowing to you, you're getting a bigger back pocket, well, that's coming out of the fact that they're getting a smaller back pocket. You're conscious because you're people in relationship with others, that stuff comes to you, it comes at the other guy's expense. Because they don't just exist over there in the distance. Somehow we are all interconnected in relationship. If more floods my way, it's actually had to flood from someone else's back pocket. This is not us anymore. God, in the mercy of Jesus Christ, has transferred us above the line to now live new lives that are no longer callous, no longer greedy. We are now people in relationship with other people. And today, particularly, Paul paints the picture of what this looks like in sexuality. What does this look like as we live sexual relationships with other people? Next week, the bit of passage is missing. I will get that next week. He speaks about how we to therefore live as people in relationship with others, in how we speak with each other. Because I am in relationship with Mark, our relationship matters. I need to speak actually truth to him. If I speak lies to Mark, that destroys our relationship. This we'll look at next week. This week, what we're looking at is that because we're in relationship with others, our relationships matter. And so the encouragement Paul gives us is that it's sexually pure lies because relationships matter. It's not about you gaining sexual satisfaction for yourself. It's about you in relationship with other people. And that's the core thing to maintain and preserve and care for in this world. Okay, I'm going to give 5 bits of application for how we are to live sexually pure lives because relationships matter. It comes under the heading, what are your relationships like? It's not how are you as the individual person going to progress in life, but what are your relationships like with each other? How is what you are doing now affecting other people around you? These are now the questions we ask as people who live above the line. For the sake of our relationships, how can we live sexually pure lives? Because these relationships matter. 5 things I want to mention. First of all, we need to know the difference between men and women. We're conscious how our blokes and girls are different. Now, there's more men here today than the women, so please don't feel too overwhelmed by the number of guys. It'll be for your good that I speak to them as well. The true generalisation, which is a generalisation but is still got a lot of truth in it, for the men, we typically operate with our eyes. What we see turns us on. It's what we see that gets us going. And so on the campus, in church, the girls look pretty. And because the girls look beautiful and pretty, that excites us. Blokes like girls because they just look good. Now, let's just put this in perspective. The girls live in a different realm. For the girls, generally speaking, it's the conversation that excites them and gets them going. For the girls, it's not how the guys look all the time. Actually, often it's more just the fact that they turn a listening ear and just the fact that they happily have a chat about something that really excites the women. Now, these are wonderful differences that God has hardwired in us, which we are to enjoy and makes our relationships wonderful. We're to also make sure that because of them, we don't deliver false hope to one another. So for the women, how you look just as you are, actually, the blokes love it. For the women, it's the case of just be conscious that you don't overdo it. For the blokes, when you are gentle with the girls and how you speak and listen, they know you're there for them and gentle and caring, and that's just what they need. For you, also, don't overdo it. If you're chatting with her for half an hour after Bible talk, and you end up chatting with her for the same half an hour for 3 weeks in a row, for her, she goes home thinking, wow, he's chatted to me for half an hour for 3 weeks in a row. This is really nice. There's something going on here. You at 2:30 every day go home on the bus and you've forgotten her name. You don't even know who she is. But that's just you as a guy for whom talking actually means nothing at all. But for her, the fact that you've been talking, she's over the moon. And so for the guys, just be conscious of the fact that you're talking with the girls for you, it's a sign of care and affection, and you want to do it, but it means a lot to the girls. And for the women as well, your prettiness means a lot to the guys as well. Second, we need to get sex and marriage in the right order. Sex and marriage in the right order. Now, I don't just mean save sex for heterosexual marriage, which I do. I'll speak of that more in 2 weeks' time when Paul talks about marriage. What I mean by this, even more, is that which one is made for the other? Is sex made for the sake of marriage, or is marriage made for the sake of sex? Let's think about the difference here. Marriage is made for the sake of sex, which is what our world thinks, how we operate then is we need to get the ticket of marriage so that we can go and have sex. That is how our world thinks. The end game here is sleeping with someone. I've got to get hold of marriage so I can get to that point. That is not how God has made the world. Rather, God has made sex for the sake of marriage. Sex for the sake of marriage. The end game is actually a committed marriage relationship. And for that end, God gives sex. Sex is like a glue that bonds people together, which is why people have a sexual history. They are glued and bonded to those around them. They can't be easily undone. The gospel cleanses completely. There's full forgiveness. But that bondedness sticks around. And sex is a powerful glue that God has made. But he's given it to do a bonding work between a man and a woman. You get sex and marriage in the right order. Marriage is the goal. Sex is given for the sake of a healthy marriage to bond them together. Third, 1 Timothy chapter 5, the first few verses is worth writing down. 1 Timothy chapter 5, the first few verses. We are family, not sex objects. We're family. We are to treat each other as brothers and sisters, as mothers, as fathers, as younger brothers, as younger sisters. This family language and family relationships is how we are as Christian people. Why this matters is that if we don't think of ourselves as family, if you meet a girl, if you're a guy, it ends up becoming, if I get closer to her, it means a relationship is going to happen. If I don't relate, I'm going to stay away. For the girls as well, you can't actually approach a guy. If you get closer and closer, what that means is you're coming together to have a relationship with the guy. The family language is so helpful because it destroys the sexually charged overlay that comes to our relationships. Because it means I can come and treat Ellen as sister. So we can have an appropriate brotherly sisterliness that allows a closeness that isn't sexually charged, which is how our world thinks. And also means that I can't stand at a distance because she's my sister, for whom I care and respect. We are to treat each other as brother and as sister, which allows appropriate intimacy.
Will that question time either now or like later?
You may. I've got two more. Jump in now, yes.
Oh, just saying, like, how do you establish that sort of relationship without then leading on a girl?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just openness?
Openness. For the guys, not too much openness, because that makes them warm to you even more.
Be really careful of the emotions questions and the how's your faith walk going. Those deeply personal questions.
Girls can really, okay.
Yeah, like the guys can just be really caring, and for the girls that means a lot. So they're kind of, you know, what has God taught you lately? That can be okay, but, you know, how is your faith going can be a bit more, that's starting to build a lot of relationship very deeply. Yeah.
We can also do more of just what I'm doing now, just to put it out there and have those conversations and be conscious of how we are relating to each other. Fourth, we need to work at it. There in verse 22, it's not just we are above the line and all of a sudden, hurrah, sexual morality. No, we need to put off the old self, the old dress code still lingers with us now sitting up here. Put off the old self. If you struggle with pornography, chat to one of the blokes, chat to one of the girls, and get an internet filter so that you don't suffer from going to pornography all the time. Do things, work hard, work at it to make sure that you live sexually pure lives. Put off the old self. Stick your hand to the plough to make sure it happens. If you need to chat to me or someone else to keep yourself accountable, please do so. And finally, not just tip your hand to the plough, work at your heart. We are desiring people. The puppet master behind our actions and our thinking is our heart beneath. Work at your heart. It has been renewed, our thinking in our hearts, after Jesus Christ in holiness and the likeness of God. Work at it. Work at your desires. A little alliteration on P's, which might be helpful here. People before personal progress. People is more important than personal progress. People, because it just makes us think of the new reality that we're in. It's my relationship with the person. That person matters more than my personal progress. Let's work hard at desiring to serve the people rather than giving my heart to serving my personal gain. Lots going on here. Tim's throwing a question out. I'm sure there'll be more, and there's more to chat about Tim's as well. Let's keep talking with each other, caring with each other, living out this life to which God has called us, a life of purity. A life to enjoy, of relationship as brothers and sisters, when you get married, as husbands and wives, if you end up down that path. Let's enjoy our brotherly, sisterliness, husband-wifeness, but with the big warning sign, Jesus is coming, let's not misuse this great gift God has given of each other. Live sexually pure lives, because our relationships really do matter. Let's pray. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for your word that is a lamp to our feet that guides us in how to live. Father, please grant us the desire to live pure lives. We thank you for Jesus who has transferred us to this new realm. Strengthen us, Father, to put off the old self. Help us to crucify those old passions and desires and to desire what is right and good and true. And Father, we ask that you preserve us in this for the sake of our fellowship with one another. And also, Father, might our living this way be a sign to others of our belonging to you, and also might they desire to come and know where we get this from, and might we point them to Jesus Christ. And I pray this in his name. Amen.